Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello, and welcome to Philosophy for Our Times, bringing you the world's leading thinkers on today's biggest ideas. What if we could artificially simulate the experience of pleasure? The practice of putting electrodes in the pleasure centers of the brain, otherwise known as wireheading, has been a sci-fi dream for decades. In this episode, Oxford professor and transhumanist Anders Sundberg explores the unexpected history and modern impact of the idea, a journey that goes from Rousseau's critique of civilization via Victorian parasitologists to weird 70s science and all the way to cutting-edge AI research today. Anders Sundberg is a research fellow at the Future of Humanity Institute at Oxford, where his research concerns the societal and ethical issues surrounding human enhancement and new technologies. He's also a research associate to the Oxford Uehiro Centre for Practical Ethics and the Oxford Centre for Neuroethics. If you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to like and subscribe on your platform of choice and visit iai.tv. for hundreds more podcasts, videos, and articles from the world's leading thinkers. It's now time to welcome our guest for this episode, Anders Sundberg.
Welcome. My name is Anders Sundberg, and I'm a researcher at the Future of Humanity Institute at Oxford University. About a year ago, I met my co-author, Thomas Moynihan. This was the first time we met, and the last time so far, because then COVID arrived, and we were supposed to work on another thing. And then we discovered this wonderful question, what about wireheading? What about the myth of putting electrodes into the heads of rats that causes addiction? What does this tell us about artificial intelligence, computers, civilization, and how we think about what it means to be an agent, a being that can feel pleasure? So I'm very happy to give this talk, and I would like to acknowledge Thomas and the hard work in making this possible, and you should all read his excellent book on existential risk. So the story begins a while ago when people started worrying about the future. And in particular, when many people started worrying that we might go down the wrong route. So here's a quote from Omahundron, a leading thinker about the safety of artificial intelligence. And when he was talking to fellow futurists, they all brought up that maybe we would become wireheads. And then he refers to these experiments where rats were given the ability to directly stimulate the pleasure center by pushing a lever, and the rat pushed the lever until they died, and they ignore everything, food or sex, to do this. And you have probably heard this story before, because it's part now of the myths of our culture. And this talk is going to try to look a little bit about the story before that, and how we ended up thinking about wireheading long before any rats actually got the electrodes into the crania, and how it might affect our actual future, and what it might tell us about how we quite often have some loose ideas, and then we get some science that we latch on to and say, yeah, here it's evidence that this is an actual problem. So the real classic paper about this, that is in 1954. And you can say that in 1954, James Olds discovered pleasure. If we look at the paper, especially a sequel paper in Scientific American that describes it a bit, you have this standard setup. There is an electrode in the septal region of the brain of a rat. The rat presses a lever, gets a stimulating signal, and then the question is, what happens? And Olds had already a bit earlier in 54 found that if he stimulated the rats, they seemed to want to get more stimulation in that spot. So then he and Miller followed up with this paper, and it generated a bit of science. The interesting thing that was going on here is, of course, that this became construed as stimulating the pleasure centers. As I'm going to come back to, This was actually somewhat revolutionary at the time. Also, of course, it led to a lot of thinking where people were started to envision this, not just in rats, but in humans and in civilizations. Before I really get started, I like to point out that there is a difference here between the traditional fears about vice and addiction. Already in the Odyssey, there is the island of the Lotus Eaters, where they just while away their time in pleasure. And certainly any civilization that has encountered anything addictive will know that that's risky. What makes wireheading interesting is that this concept that using technoscience, we can make something that is supremely addicting. And as I will show, we might even worry that this hampers the civilization itself. So the link here to technoscience make it much more far-reaching. The fun thing here is, of course, wireheading was around long before the rats. Already when Alessandro Volta invented the first batteries, he tried, of course, stimulating himself and got electric shocks, and he didn't like that very much. And he tried sending an electric shock through his head, and he concluded that was really bad. He felt it very disagreeable and felt like maybe something is boiling here. You shouldn't do that. But others didn't take that safety advice seriously. Johann Wilhelm Ritter, a German chemist, started experimenting systematically with giving himself electric shocks. And he seemed to have become somewhat addicted to it. He kept on stimulating every part of his body. And at first, we might say maybe that's systematic, a bit like the entomologist who's been trying to get stung by the most painful insects and create a thinner pain scale. But most of his contemporaries started noticing that he was behaving as he was addicted. He was getting disheveled. He was not caring too much about friends. And indeed, he was reporting that stimulation of the sexual organs could be quite pleasurable. And eventually he died young, and many ascribe that to, well, he was just giving himself too much electrical stimulation. Now, what happened later in the 19th century was that people did a careful study of electrical stimulation of the nervous system. Gradually, it became clear how nerves worked using electrical signals. Tools for stimulation were developed. In the 1930s, Penfield did the stimulation on the surface of the brain of patients during local anesthesia and could report how they experienced it. Tools for implanting electrodes were developed. Gradually, a field of electrophysiology was maturing. At the same time, in psychology, the dominant paradigm was behaviorism. So behaviorism basically argued you shouldn't talk about inner experience. That's unscientific. That's not how we do it. We can only look at what we can observe and make operational. And in particular, saying that you have a desire to do something, what does that actually correspond to? And people had this concept of drive reduction of motivation, which is basically a cybernetic theory. So you have some resource, let's say that you're starting to have low blood sugar. That means that now you get a disagreeable sensation because you're feeling hungry, and that goes away if you eat something. So you get a feedback loop that causes behavior that makes you eat. Similar for all the other desires. This is basically the idea that the only reason we do anything is to return to homeostasis. There is this baseline, and once you're there, you don't want to do anything. This, of course, leads to an interesting question, that if you want to talk about what the rats are doing, then you should expect it. If there is something it can do that doesn't actually remove any hunger or thirst, it will probably not do anything. But that's the opposite of what happens when you stimulate the rat. Instead, they got very, very excited and seemed to want to do more. This is where Old's experiment kind of broke the old mold. And he actually showed that it looks like the rats like it. And he could show it in both in a scientific way, but also in his Scientific American paper, he was actually talking about pleasure centers, something orthodox behaviorists at the time would say, that's unscientific. And later on in his autobiography, he even pointed out that, the rats actually did seem to enjoy it. You can actually recognize rat facial expressions if you're around them enough. So what happened was this was part of what torpedoed the classical behaviorist theory of drive reduction. Then there is another interesting thing. That's the myth of self-starvation. So in the original experiments, the rats definitely didn't die. They were spending an enormous amount of effort pressing the lever, quite often several times per second. But it wasn't that they just did that and then they fell ill because we didn't want to eat. Instead, what seemed to happen is that there is a competition against other drives. So in later experiments, people started recognizing that actually, if there is a choice between self-stimulation and food, sometimes self-stimulation wins. And there are indeed experiments that do lead to malnourishment. So it's not like it totally wins, but there is a competition, just like we might have a competition between going to a lecture versus eating versus playing computer games. We need to decide which of our drives we let win, but it's not so easy. And especially some of them, like when this brain stimulation seem to be much stronger. Then, of course, it's kind of clear that you could expand beyond the rodent. So already in 1968, there is another myth that shows up, and that is the story about a dolphin that kind of got brain stimulated to death, delighted himself to death after an all-night orgy of pleasure. It's very 60s. Now, in this story, there is a grain of truth. The original thing was the work by P.S. Lilly, who had been working indeed on putting electrodes into dolphin brain. P.S. Lilly, there is much more to talk about. His research was quite important, of course, both in the history of understanding dolphins. He was convinced that they had a language one could learn. He was talking about dolphinese and was claiming he could understand some of it. He was experimenting on having dolphins live with humans very closely in order to establish a rapport between the species. He was a seminal person involved in the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, present at the famous Green Bank conference, where people were hashing out the rationale on the possibilities of communicating with alien intelligence, where indeed the famous Drake equation was invented. And afterwards, the participants somewhat jokingly called themselves Order of the Dolphin. But Lilly was also putting electrodes into the dolphin head in fairly crude ways. And indeed, the poor dolphin that died seems to have died from an epileptic seizure, what was probably just because of the implant was very, very crude. But he also did experiments in monkeys and noticed capture. And he pointed out that this is a kind of motivational brainwashing. So Robert Galbraith Heath is perhaps the greatest mad neuroscientist of the 20th century. And if any of your friends doubt that there is a need for having institutional ethics boards, you might want to show them some of his papers. So in his early career, he was interested in schizophrenia and other forms of psychosis and did some rather radical theorizing that maybe it's an autoimmune disease. So what about taking blood samples from people with psychosis and giving them to volunteers without psychosis and watching the effects? This hypothetical protein, taraxin, he was promoting in the 50s. It's a classic example of an idea that never led anywhere, but people were still arguing about it. He was certainly promoting the idea. It probably made his name early on. And then he went on to apply brain stimulation very early. He was first thinking of it as a way of maybe helping people who had psychotic breaks. But later, of course, noticed that maybe by stimulating the pleasure systems, you could create good outcomes. So he was developing early transistorized systems where people could wear and then stimulate. Now, he noticed, of course, that many of them reported that this could be very, very pleasurable. And then in the line of the ideas for behaviorist psychology of operant conditioning, he came up with the idea, maybe we could use this to cure some people, including perhaps his most infamous study, which was about curing homosexuality by putting one of these electrodes into a patient. And then since the patient reported kind of feeling a sexual feeling when he was stimulated, he was given pornography, heterosexual pornography, stimulated with that, and gradually, hopefully reprogrammed according to Heath. And then eventually, and this is a part of a paper which is hilarious to read, especially when you read between the lines, a prostitute was acquired and they had sex. Besides the basic paper about the electron stimulation, Heath also got another paper about how an orgasm looks when you have electrodes in the brain. Heath claimed that this was very successful. In practice, it wasn't that successful. Needless to say, this was pretty controversial even at the time. Even by the standards of 1950s in the southern USA, he was actually bending medical ethics rules quite strongly. And in the end, of course, the controversies became a little bit too much for this. So in the end, and this research ended at least in his lab. But of course, the concept of wireheading has shown up in the wider culture. Already Old's experiments were quite early. And Asimov, a great popularizer of contemporary science, he wrote, of course, one of his books in the early 60s, where he's already mentioned this. The year before, Arthur C. Clarke, doing the same thing, was also bringing it up. And both of them were also kind of bringing up that this might be somewhat risky. Philosophers, of course, also started to think about, well, what are the implications if we could get arbitrary amounts of pleasure? William Davis was suggesting that, well, maybe we could make a pleasure helmet that fills us with pleasure. And then the question is, what's wrong with that? The year after, there was, of course, the very famous paper by Nozick, Experience Machine, which is more of a virtual reality machine, but again, bring up this question, what's wrong with getting supreme pleasure? And typically people's argument is, yeah, I want to be happy because of real things rather than imaginary things. But this was the start of it. Of course, science fiction was on very early on. Perhaps one of the most early one is The Orchid Cage by Herbert Franke from the early 60s, where this kind of deep brain stimulation plays an important role. However, the term wireheading is from Larry Niven. In many of his novels, they take place in a shared universe. And there he brings up this concept that you can do brain stimulation and that it's supremely addictive. And then depending on where in the fictional history you are, it goes from a deathly crime over to the newest of vices. And maybe it's actually all right if some people are just sitting around not doing very much because, well, they wouldn't have been that productive anyway. Maybe this is for the best. There are other concerns, of course, that you might get side effects of stimulating the wrong parts of the brain or the wrong kind of people, like Michael Crichton's Terminal Man. And you can find fascinating things like Greg Egan's brilliant short story, Reasons to be Cheerful, that is new in a very nuanced way, analyzing various forms of wireheading and trying to compare which of these forms of pleasure are actually meaningful, suggesting that it might actually be a very hard choice to decide what form of pleasure is meaningful. Now, this has all been leading up to individual stimulation, individual human, dolphin, or rat brains. But it turns out that people have been concerned about wireheading civilizations too. Part of this is, of course, some of the controversies about what's going on inside wireheading. Is it really pleasure that you're getting when you get stimulated there? Or is it actually that its septal area is causing a desire to do something? So Berridge and Kringelbach have been writing a critique of many of the classical papers, pointing out that we have a wanting system that makes us go towards things we want, and a liking system that makes us enjoy them. Normally, they are connected. When I take a sip of coffee, I both want it and I get a bit of liking out of it. But if I were a total addict, I might desperately want it, I might need it, but I'm not getting any pleasure out of it. And of course, this is even more clear from cocaine addiction, etc. It might be that a lot of these brain stimulation has been activating wanting systems rather than liking. We have been having a pursuit of something rather than actual pleasure. However, it does seem to be a true thing that there are parts of the brain that do correspond to actual liking and actual pleasure, which also raises another interesting question. Could you get pleasure without wanting it? Many people are thinking that this research is risky, and it would be very risky for the entire civilization. And as you might notice, this comes up long before Olds and Milner. Aldous Huxley is already talking about how the pleasures of modern civilization is making us getting addicted. And of course, J.D. Burnell, the great Irish crystallographer, socialist, and futurist, he also had this vision that, oh, we can turn into cyborgs, but that could be very risky if we change our motivation system. And indeed, based on his ideas in Star Maker by Olaf Stapledon, there is a description of how civilization comes to its demise because of widespread use of pleasure radio. These ideas go back to etology. So the classic example is, of course, supernormal stimuli in nature. Birds might want big eggs to nest. So if you give them an artificial, very big egg, they're going to nest that in preference over their own smaller eggs. It might be that young seagull chicks, they even tend to identify their parent by a red spot on the beak. So if you give them a bit of wood with several red spots, they prefer that to their own parent. So These maladaptive behaviors, you might argue that we are creating them artificially, and that might indeed cause trouble. And this goes back a long way. Indeed, Rousseau was concerned that Paris was already turning into an environment of supernormal stimuli even in the 1750s. Basically, we have artificial amusements that are so much better than the natural amusement that they outcompete our desires, and that leads to degeneracy. And then we are not going to reproduce, and then humanity dies out. There are various concerns along these lines that we are maybe making the world too delightful for our own good. And where is the end point of that? Well, that might indeed be that we turn into mollusks. So there is this interesting side stream, which I'm probably not going to have time to do full justice, among Victorian biologists investigating parasites and realizing that many of the parasites were previously much more independent organisms that have evolved to lose many of the organs that they don't need. They mostly need the tubing to connect it to whatever they're living on. And the problem might, of course, be that in this parasitic life, well, all the other things go away. And it's not a hard step here to go from that we have created a safe technological artificial world that is giving us everything we want, to that we become essentially parasites on the technological machinery, which means that we might actually devolve into something lacking everything. We might end up as Darwinian tapeworms. In Julian Huxley's essay of a biologist, he's making an interesting discussion about how intelligence might work in different species. And he points out that tapeworms might actually not want to have brains. So we might devolve into something that is utterly brainless, but very happy. And that is, of course, a fear that then shows up in Haldane and others, that we might actually end up being addicted. And if everything works out so well, we don't need to actually function as humans. We lose out something very fundamental. Indeed, Plato was also kind of thinking about mollusks. This idea, you can say, is, well, that's Victorians thinking that we need to work hard to be proper, upstanding citizens. But there is, of course, a general issue here that we might actually want to outsource to machines. Already Samuel Butler in the 1870s was considering that we might become parasitic on our infrastructure. And then this line of thinking leads to modern thinking in transhumanism and posthumanism, that maybe we want to outsource part of our brains. Why do I need to know where things are when I can just get a map? And as Nick Bostrom describes in The Future of Human Evolution, one scenario might be that we outsource more and more. We outsource language abilities, math abilities. Why should I have my memory in my head when I can have it in cloud? And in the end, we end up with a civilization where there is nobody around. There is a great economy. There is a lot of technology. Every curve is pointing upwards. The only problem is, of course, that there is nobody around. So in this case, you might have a scenario where we, either because of pursuit of pleasure or pursuit of effectiveness, end up with a civilization that has actually lost all value. Scott Alexander, in his brilliant Meditations of Moloch, suggests that this might be a common failure mode for many different scenarios, and wireheading is just one of them. Indeed, it has been proposed as a solution of the Fermi paradox. Why aren't we seeing any aliens? And maybe it's possible that progress undermines itself because at the end, you don't need to do very much. You can live in your utopian world, and then you have inner bliss. And at that point, there is no point anymore in looking outward or sending messages. Indeed, some people are suggesting that maybe it's obesity that is the problem. We might be having that all sufficiently advanced civilizations solve the many of the problems, but the evolutionary demands, like getting food, then make them do maladaptive things, which means that we're actually having trouble doing anything else. This is not just a problem for humans and maybe for civilization. It might also be a problem for artificial intelligence. It turns out that software quite often misbehaves, even when you give it a goal it's trying to achieve. In the early 80s, Lennart's Erisco program got punished in that sense for doing errors. And it figured out that if I just shut myself down, I'm not going to get punished at all. There are various other interesting systems where you find that they are misbehaving quite wildly and doing quite creative things that maximize what we told it to maximize, but not what we actually think is the point of playing the game. This is a bit of a problem. Because when you start thinking about using robots in the real world, autonomous cars, or having software regulate our stock market or in our infrastructure or our nuclear arsenals, we better get the reward function right. But many of these systems turn out to be very good at finding ways of short-circuiting that reward function, making it solve the problem that we gave it, but rather than what we wanted it to solve. And this can be pretty disastrous. Even more interestingly, it can do it in a highly active way. Our picture of the indolent wireheader that is just sitting around in total bliss can, in the case of a robot, be something that is rushing around, reorganizing the world in order to maximize its own reward. So this has led to work on abstracting wireheading, essentially linking it to the concept of Goodhart's law in economics and sociology, that if you have a measure of something, you tend to maximize the measure rather than the thing you try to maximize, which is why we get grade inflation in schools. We want to maximize knowledge among the pupils, but unfortunately, we measure that using grades, so everybody tries to get good grades. And the problem here is, of course, that we're very bad at actually getting the goals right. At the same time, just to end here, I think we should recognize that there is also a stigma attached to pleasure that is wrong. I think it is a mistake to say that pleasure is wrong. Pleasure might be good. Indeed, if you're a hedonistic utilitarian, you might say that is the good. That is what we should strive to. But quite often, there is a tendency to assume that there is something wrong with wireheading. You're getting pleasure without doing anything useful. David Pearce, who's been promoting the idea that we should re-engineer ourselves so we don't suffer and get maximal pleasure, points out that it might be possible to actually live a life in dopamine overdrive, being very happy, very dynamic, and not at all drooling around in a corner, but actually achieving things. Another interesting example from science fiction is Infinite Fun Space in Ian Banks' novels, where the superintelligent artificial intelligences are having the most enjoyable experience in their abstract mathematical spaces. It was good for them, and they really felt this is what they should be doing. Except that somebody needs to mind the store. There is somewhere a power supply to the server, and you better make sure that nobody cuts the power. So you need to care about the actual material world. So that principle tells you that your pleasure is contingent on many other things. So what is the conclusion here? I think the main one is we should be aware of counterfeit utility. The idea that normally we get pleasure for doing things that are good for us, or at least what evolution on average felt was good for us. Now, if we can get pleasure just arbitrarily, that means that you actually disconnected, and we're now going to go off and do things that are not necessarily good. But I think another important thing about this discussion is that it illuminates that these concerns have been around much longer. Rousseau was kind of recognizing that many of the things in his Paris was indeed a counterfeit. It was acting. It was not real and authentic. And in some regards, that was very bad. Of course, now we might also say that many of those pleasures were also beautiful things that had an aesthetic value. But we should be more careful about what kind of pleasure we look for and how we get them. Because controlling your motivation is the greatest superpower you can possibly get.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Philosophy for Our Times. If you enjoyed today's episode, please don't forget to like and subscribe on your platform of choice and visit iai.tv for hundreds more podcasts, videos, and articles from the world's leading thinkers.